It's a great pleasure to be back at the University of Virginia Law School. It's hard to realize how quickly decades run. When I was a student here, there was essentially no patent coverage in the curriculum at all. There was a little bit of copyright. Trademark and trade secret were maybe 10 minutes and part of some other course. And look at the law school now, leading the country with a large and diverse and very prominent intellectual property faculty. It shows the ability of the law school to keep up with the times and actually to surge ahead of the competition, which of course is important, because there is competition for the best students and the best faculty, and it takes momentum and energy and focus to provide that kind of leadership. So I'm thrilled to see that the school that I feel prepared me so well for what ensued in almost five decades since leaving Charlottesville continues to prepare young lawyers in a maximum sort of way. I'd like to also observe that my decision to try to make a career out of stringing together one public assignment or appointment or office after another had its genesis right here on the grounds in Charlottesville. Because there were many teachers, even in the early 60s when I was here, who supported the idea of public service. Of course, Thomas Jefferson exemplified public service in many important roles at the founding era of our country. So it goes way back. It's a long and great tradition. But Virginia Law School in the 40s and 50s produced so many prominent private practitioners that many people probably assumed, at least in that era, that it was mainly the spawning ground for great Wall Street lawyers and big firm lawyers. And it was, and it still is, and rightly so. But already at that early era, in the early 60s, there was a strong encouragement by the faculty here for the pursuit of public good and public offices, not necessarily as a career, but maybe as an intermittent kind of thing. And I mention that because some of you in this room may face those kind of opportunities, may be able to move back and forth between private practice and public office. The talent level of the private bar in the United States is one of the great assets of this country. There is no other country, in my opinion, that has the extraordinary depth and breadth of legal talent as we do here in America. And for various reasons of career and financial obligations that people have, particularly if they have families, children, and debt, and so forth, public service is difficult because it's not as rewarding financially. And that's why this tradition of people being in private practice but then taking a stint in public service, in the Justice Department, in a regulatory agency, on Capitol Hill with a substantive committee, or many other assignments like that, and then returning to private practice, and then maybe 5 or 10 years later, leaving the law firm or the law office, whatever it may be, and going back into public service and so forth. But for me, it ended up being a continuous process. So I graduated in 1966 and went to work in public office and served continuously in one public office after another until May 31st of 2010, so nearly 50 years. And I have to say, I never had a boring day. I never felt I was working on anything that was unimportant or unchallenging. So I can recommend not only intermittent public service to all of you, faculty and guests and students alike, but also the possibility of really trying to make a career out of it. Now, I want to try to stimulate some of the discussion that will ensue at this conference by taking you a little bit on a tour through a period of approximately a decade from three different perspectives. You will not read about this in the New York Times or other publications like that. This was a little bit below the radar, but very, very important. So first I'm going to take you through the decade from the perspective of criticism of the patent system, the patent office, the patent cases in the courts. So I'm going to call that a decade of criticism. And then I'm going to tour you through the same decade, approximately a decade. It roughly corresponds with the period of 2002 to now. Or you could think of it as the last full decade from 2000 to 2010. But that's the period I want to talk about. So the same decade that was a decade of rising criticism was also, ironically, a decade of rising neglect by the Congress, of the courts, of the patent office, of the Food and Drug Administration, and the other instruments of government that operate the intellectual property system, and particularly the patent system in this country. The third perspective I want to take you through over the same time period is what I'll call the decade of the hearings. Hearings in regulatory agencies, some of which were supervised by my friend and former colleague, Suzanne Michel. I wish she were a relative, but she isn't. But she was a law clerk with me early in my tenure on the court and did an absolutely stellar job and has been a friend and a colleague ever since. So the decade of hearings included the Federal Trade Commission and other entities, but I'm going to concentrate particularly on the hearings in the Congress because the facts of that evolution over a decade tell us a lot about special interests, congressional competence, the relative competence of courts versus Congress. It goes back to the founding of the country, separation of powers, who's in charge of what, who's got the best ability because of its procedures to do what sort of issues. And this is, of course, central to our inquiry at this conference. And then finally, I want to discuss a little bit, and of course, cause and effect is the question here. What did the so-called patent reform debate and the legislative action produce? What is the America Invents Act all about? What is in it? How will it impact the real world? What's good? What's bad? What's the net effect? And you'll see the connections back to the three perspectives that I'll walk you through covering approximately the last decade. So our story begins early in the prior decade, in 2001-2002, when the Federal Trade Commission undertook a big examination of the patent law, the patent system, and to some extent, patent markets, but mostly the litigation part and the patent office part. So this resulted in a report published in 2003, which kind of set off a prairie fire that then just grew and continued and continued. Overlapping that, the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council put together a very distinguished group of economists, lawyers, and others to study some of the same issues. And of course, the data informing both the work of the National Academy of Sciences task group and the task group at the Federal Trade Commission was mostly data from the late 90s, because that's all the data that was readily available at that time. So then in 2004, the National Academy report came out. And many points it agreed with the Federal Trade Commission report. It added some things. It had a few twists on things, but largely to the same effect that there were perceived problems with the operation of the patent system in terms of questionable patents being issued. And I'll come back to that term because it's a very important term. Language is so important, which is one of the great underlying themes of our tour. But in any event, patents that some of which looked silly or invalid, court results that were at least startling, large damage awards, for example, hundreds of millions of dollars, a couple of cases over $1 billion. And so it got a lot of attention in the patent profession, in the policy world. And then the, you know, as they say in popular music, the beat went on. In the middle of the decade, two economists, or maybe I should say an economist and a business school professor, Jaffe and Lerner by name, came out with a monograph slamming the patent system and the work of the courts and the work of the patent office, re-echoing many of the themes of the Federal Trade Commission and the National Academy report. And this began to not only intensify the critique, but also to spread it more widely in terms of public attention. The Congress started paying a lot of attention, some of the mainstream press, particularly the Wall Street Journal, maybe not surprisingly, started to cover these topics and these reports more and more and more. And then in the latter half of the decade, the Supreme Court got in the act in a kind of a major way. Let me digress just a little bit. The Federal Circuit was created to try to improve, clarify, strengthen, rebalance, et cetera, the administration of the patent laws in this country. Previously, the patent infringement cases and related licensing contract cases went to the regional circuit after being tried in the relevant district. And the results were all over the lot. Some circuits almost never upheld the validity of a patent. Other circuits almost always upheld the validity of patents. The infringement results and the damages results were all over the lot. Several presidential commissions, particularly one in the 70s during the Carter administration, and then it was picked up by the succeeding Reagan administration, decided that somewhat in the same vein as creating the tax court for the somewhat arcane, complex tax code administration, that they should create a court that would have some concentration, some focus on the administration of the patent law. So the Federal Circuit was created in 1982. And for two decades, the Supreme Court was almost totally silent in patent law. It was a case here or there, but of very secondary importance, nothing really major. But the drumbeat of criticism of the patent system that just kept going and increasing all through the first half of that decade finally resulted in the Supreme Court re-entering the arena. And so we got the eBay decision on injunctions in the beginning of the second half of the decade. Shortly after that, we got the KSR decision on obviousness, which was a theme of critique in the Federal Trade Commission report and in the National Academy of Science report as well. A little later in the decade, we got a second report from the Federal Trade Commission, entirely the work of Suzanne Michel, and perhaps she'll talk about this a little bit later, that focused a lot on some emerging trends, which actually were barely visible at the time of the original work by the Federal Trade Commission, having to do with non-practicing entities, markets for patent sales, whole portfolios being sold, and a great many things like that. One of the great things about having law clerks is that they not only facilitate the work of courts, but they also enliven the lives of judges. So almost all of your clerks end up becoming friends, and almost like family, almost like nieces and nephews. So I was quick to respond yes when Suzanne Michel asked me to be the lead-off speaker at some hearings in the middle of that decade that led to her second report, just as I was quick to say yes to the invitation of your journal to be here today. Later in the decade, Professors Besson and Muir came out with another monograph, and again slamming the patent system in very strong terms, sort of Jaffe and Lerner on steroids, might be a way to describe it. Then we had the Supreme Court re-enter the lists for the first time in decades with respect to eligibility for patenting with the Bielski decision, and then more recently in the current decade, the Mayo case. And if that weren't enough, of course, we ended up in 2011 with the passage of what became called the America Invents Act. And then in the current year, rather than some decrease in the volume or intensity of commentary and criticism, Bessin and Muir came out with another book, not quite a book, it's a book in making, I guess, but with a study that was published sort of in the form of a long article, I guess. And my friend and colleague, Judge Richard Posner from the Seventh Circuit, not only tossed out a patent infringement case involving Apple and Samsung, as I recall, but followed that up with an article in the Atlantic magazine suggesting that the patent system had such deep flaws that it might be retarding more innovation than it was promoting, and that's caused a sensation at the level of the popular press. Of course, Congress throughout the decade grew increasingly attentive to the criticisms and the outcry and the constant suggestion that the patent system was broken, was out of control, was counterproductive, was something very bad. And so more recently, we've had bills introduced or discussed at least to create a strong bias toward shifting the fees, attorney's fees and other costs of litigation onto the shoulders of the party that doesn't prevail. And I take it that this bill is mainly designed to try to frighten potential plaintiffs who own patents from filing suit because of worry that they'd have to pay millions and millions of dollars if they don't prevail. Of course, fee shifting has a useful and important appropriate role, but the legislative proposal on the table seemed quite connected to what our topic emphasizes, special interest lobbying. And there's also proposed legislation to prevent patent owners who aren't making a product from availing themselves of exclusion orders in the International Trade Commission, or perhaps being able to even litigate in the International Trade Commission. So if we consider the decade behind and the rest of the current decade and ask ourselves, well, is patent reform or patent revision, as I prefer to call it, because reform implies improvement. And that's not always what you get when you send something to the Congress, because what comes out often looks very different from what went in, and the process of making the sausage is quite extreme, and I'll get into that in a minute. But some people say this was a generational update of the patent law. Last major revision, some would say, is 1952. There actually have been many, many important amendments of the patent law. So it's a big exaggeration to say we had the 52 Act and we had nothing for more than a half a century, and then we had the America Invents Act. But lots of people who liked the bill said that because it kind of sounded good. So in any event, it was certainly a comprehensive and major set of amendments to the patent statute that goes back to the work of the first Congress in 1790. And of course, the patent system is hatched in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, where even before Congress is authorized to create an army or navy, they're authorized to create a patent system. It was that important to the founders. Remember, we were a dependent colony of a world empire, Britain. We were agricultural, poor. It wasn't clear we could survive economically if we broke our commercial ties with Britain. And so the founders, particularly James Madison, but also Jefferson and the others, gave great priority to encouraging the creation of a strong property-based patent system. In any event, some people say, okay, well, we've had this once every 50 years revision of the patent law. It's done. Now Congress will slumber for another half century or so, and then maybe they'll update it again. In my prediction, nothing could be further from the truth. Where we really are is at halftime of the football game with a tie score. So the game is about to resume, and it will be even bloodier in the second half than it was in the first half. And therefore, the topic your journal has chosen is timely. This isn't history. This is a backward look in order to get ready for the forward action, because it's coming the day that Congress returns to Washington, D.C. on January 21st, or whatever it is, 2013. And of course, it will matter who is the president. It will matter who's in the majority in each house. It will matter in detail which specific incumbents survive and which don't, and who becomes the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee and other key positions like that. The decade of criticism also became a decade where the criticism shifted from public bodies like the Trade Commission and the National Academy to academia and the private sector. And so you began to see the criticism show up in many law review articles. So, for example, Professor Mark Lemley at Stanford Law School, who's a friend of mine, so I don't mean to sound unduly critical, came out in his prolific style with, I think, dozens of articles over the course of just a few years, mostly very critical of the operation of the patent system by the courts, and also the operation of the patent granting process in the Patent and Trademark Office. And many other academics also participated in assessment, entirely proper, and contributed to the public debate in a meaningful way. But my point is, it started out with government bodies, it spread, and things began showing up in the Wall Street Journal on a very regular basis that echoed and intensified and spread some of the criticism. The other thing that happened, which will segue us into one of the other perspectives, is that certain small but powerful segments of the private sector got hugely motivated to try to have the patent system reshaped in ways beneficial to their business model, their bottom line, perfectly appropriate, constitutionally guaranteed, to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And petition they did. I haven't been able to independently verify this, but I've read that in the course of the patent reform debates on Capitol Hill, that there were 3,000 registered lobbyists, and that the total lobbying bill was over $300 million. And that doesn't even count the PR firms and the law firms. That's just the lobby firms. So there was a massive campaign, and we'll get into a little bit of that. So that was also kind of quite a distance from the Federal Trade Commission report or the National Academy report. Now we were in a whole new arena. And so thoughtful academic analysis and criticism and official body criticism started to morph more toward polemics, propaganda, special interest lobbying of the most vehement sort. So you began to hear phrases like broken patent system, wasteful litigation, low quality patents, frivolous lawsuits, patent thickets, royalty stacking, holdups, excessive damages, venue abuse. Now, of course, there is some truth in all those things. I don't mean to suggest that the system is optimal, it's certainly not perfect. Of course, no system could be perfect, but that's another matter. But my point is that analytical thinking backed up by data and logic and cause and effect connection started to give way more and more and more to just raw lobbying power, including the use of language, which I would say is designed to prevent careful thinking, not assist it. So that's why I mentioned some of those terms. Okay, the same decade that the Congress became so involved and the media got so energized. What else was happening? Starting in 1999, but it still roughly corresponds to the prior decade, we entered what I'll call a decade of neglect. Neglect by the Congress of the instrumentalities of the government that have to operate the patent system because no one else can. Principally the Patent Office and the U.S. courts, but secondarily the International Trade Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, the Customs Service, and other elements of the government. Decade of neglect. Fee diversion. Starting in 1999, see, the Patent Office gets no taxpayer money. It's entirely funded by user fees paid under the compulsion of law by those who apply for patents, whether they're individual inventors or large corporations or any other kind of entity. So starting in 1999, the Congress turned the Patent Office budget, consisting entirely of fees, into a kind of piggy bank for special pork barrel projects. So over the course of the next 19 years, they diverted over $900 million in fee money. Private money that was paid for one purpose under law, but the Congress diverted it to other programs and projects. Some people thought fee diversion had ended because for several years in the late 2000s, there wasn't any fee diversion. But in 2010, another $200 million went out the window. So in all, over about two decades, about $1 billion destined for the Patent Office was siphoned off by the Congress deliberately for other purposes. So fee diversion was a terrible problem. In addition to diverting fees, the fee levels were controlled exclusively by the Congress. So when the work of the Patent Office went up hugely, as it did throughout that decade, the fees weren't raised, and therefore the funding became grossly inadequate. The mismatch between the workload and the resources, the number of examiners, the quality of examiners, got totally out of whack. In addition, the information technology systems weren't updated, improved, and expanded. Consider this. This might be termed the federal government's premier technology agency, but it had 20-year-old hardware. It had totally inadequate software. It was a mess. In sworn testimony, in his first appearance before the Congress in early 2010, the new director, still there, David Kappos, had to testify that the IT systems were dysfunctional. That is a disgrace and is a direct result of the congressional pilfering of the fee levels and suppressing the fee levels as well. So the results were exactly what you'd guess. Too few examiners, too few experienced examiners, trouble keeping experienced examiners, all of the fallout from bad IT systems. It got so bad at one point that they were losing 1,000 examiners a year. So there was this churning. They lose 1,000, hire 1,000 newbies. New rookies in any line of work don't do as well as people with experience. At one point, a third of the examining corps had been there less than 3 years, which I'm told by the experts is the ramp up, the training and ramp up time, that an examiner is not really competent or productive until they've been there about 3 years. So a third of the corps were substandard, and it was just really a mess. Of course, the other fallout was long delays. Thomas Edison got his famous patent in 6 weeks. By this time, late in the prior decade, it frequently took 6 years to get a patent granted or rejected, whatever the right result is, of course. The average was 3 years, but of course you've got to remember math. You know, the average 3 years means a lot were longer than 3 years. And you would guess, and you would be right, that the more important patents with commercial significance and technological advanced state would be the ones that would take longer than 3 years, and the real easy ones for a running shoe or something would be the ones that would be done in a year and a half or 2 years. So the average of 3 years was a disaster. That's for the initial examination. For the re-examinations, the average was 4 years, and again, often longer, often upwards of a decade. So you can't enforce a patent if it's under re-examination, And those long delays were terrible. The board itself averaged 2 years to decide a case. So an examination or reexamination decision that took half a decade would take 2 more years to get through the board. And if there's an appeal to the Federal Circuit, that took another year. So we're upwards of a decade, you know, killing time delays, just terrible. And there were accuracy problems as well. Then we turn to the courts. What was happening to the courts during the same decade? There's something called a comprehensive judgeship bill, which is a systematic mathematical effort to correlate the number of judgeships and their location, but mainly the number of judgeships with the quantity and complexity of the workload so that trials can be fast and careful and appeals can be fast and careful. So in every Congress, the judiciary, as a branch, submits a judgeship request bill to the Congress. So every 2 years, such a bill goes forward. The last time the United States Congress passed a comprehensive judgeship bill was in 1991. So, of course, we don't have enough judges. So, of course, we have terrible delays in the courts, just like the patent office. In fact, very comparable. Average to get to trial, average, about 3 years. More complicated cases, busier districts, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, and plus a year on appeal at the least. So the upshot of all this was that the U.S. courts are about 100 judges short of what they need to do a minimally competent, expeditious job because of the refusal of the Congress to create the needed judgeships. Now, they did create some judgeships since 1991. I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression. But way too little, way too late, and often in the wrong place. Not where really the need was, but where some politically powerful member was able to work his or her will. So 100 judgeships short. And on top of that, we degenerated in the confirmation and nomination process to the point where, as a permanent state, we had 100 judicial vacancies, often for years. It was mentioned by Chase that I stepped down from the bench in May 31st of 2010. Okay, today's October 26, 2012. My seat has still not been filled 2.5 years later. That's typical of the problem. So the judiciary is actually operating 200 judges short of what's needed because of low priority and neglect. And it's true of both parties, both administrations, various political philosophies. It's just not sexy. It doesn't get you campaign contributions. It doesn't get you press to nominate and confirm judges rapidly. And so it ends up not happening. So the judiciary's performance is degrading in parallel to the degradation of the patent office performance throughout the last decade for exactly the same reason, because Congress won't provide the resources, mainly the money, needed to have effective litigation. 200 judges is over 20% of the workforce. So when you're 200 judges short, it's like sending an army into a war with 22% of the soldiers missing. It's idiotic. You know, who would do that? Who would think that's responsible leadership? But that's what we did. So, of course, as I said, the trials in the district courts got as slow and sometimes as sloppy as what happened in the patent office. So that was the decade of neglect. So you have the Congress on the one hand responding to lobbying pressures to, quote, reform the patent law and starting to hold hearings every year, starting, I think it was 2005 was the first bill and the first set of hearings, and then it continued every year after that, and it's continuing to today. But the same Congress, with its other duties as an appropriator, is starving all of the legal instrumentalities needed to operate the American patent system. And so the performance, of course, is going downhill badly. Okay, so that's the second perspective, the decade of criticism, the decade of neglect, and the third perspective, the decade of hearings. So I won't go into recent hearings, but the hearings that led up to the bill from 05 through 2011. I've lost count, but I read most of the record. There were dozens and dozens of witnesses. I'm going to say about 50 or 60, but don't hold me to precisely the number. Out of those several dozen or several score witnesses, how many judges who try patent cases were called by the Congress? Zero. Zero. How many judges were asked by the Congress for input? Zero. How many inventors were called among all those 60 witnesses? One token inventor. How many investment people? You know, the investment community is part of the patent system. They fund the R&D for companies that don't already have a massive revenue stream. So they're part of the system. They're a critical part of it. So I recall one person from the investment community was called in all those hearings over a six-year, seven-year period. How many leaders of small or mid-sized businesses were called as witnesses? Zero. So who was called as a witness? Well, the people called as witnesses were mostly from very large companies, global companies, and were part of the what I'll call special interest pleading. Perfectly proper, lawful, ethical, appropriate, but no one else could basically get in the room except people who represented giant, giant corporations and get heard. So the process starts out a little skewed because of who's called to the, quote, trial. Are you getting all sides of the story? Are you getting the full picture, you, the decision makers, in this case, members of the congressional committees? But it was worse than that, because when you read the record, there was a lot of contradictory testimony, and the contradictions were never ironed out. You can read the committee reports, and they never resolve any of the conflict. They just cherry-pick the things that support what they ended up putting in the bill. That makes it sound like, well, all the witnesses agreed that X, Y, and Z was needed. But all the witnesses actually didn't agree. But worse than that, the committees and ultimately the whole Congress accepted a great many bold assertions with no proof at all, with no facts, no figures, no real analysis, just sheer assertion. I'll give you one example. The general counsel of a large IT company testified that it was an intolerable problem that claim construction rulings on the scope of protection by district judges weren't allowed to be immediately appealed to the Federal Circuit for immediate review, interlocutory appeal. Of course, the norm is you need a final judgment toward taking appeal, injunctions, and special exception, and there are a few others. But basically, you need a final judgment. And so the complaint was, well, for patent law, we need a different regime. We need to be able to have an immediate appellate review of the initial claim construction. And this is before there's any summary judgment or any trial or any real serious litigation, just a naked claim construction ruling. And the witness said, the reason we need this is because what we're seeing now is expensive trials, and then the Federal Circuit reverses the claim construction, and we have to retry the case. Very inefficient, very expensive, very wasteful. I agree with all three of those criticisms. It is very expensive, wasteful, unfortunate. But the problem is, how many cases were tried to final judgment, appealed and reversed, and had to be retried? I've only been able to identify fewer than 10 cases in a decade when 1,000 cases were tried. So how big of a problem is that really? But the failure of the Congress to demand numbers, facts, figures, proof, skewed, in my opinion, the outcome. But what skewed the outcome the most of all was just heavy, heavy-duty lobbying. There was a group called the Business Software Alliance that got going, spent a lot of money, hired a lot of very talented people, walked the halls of Congress. There's something, you probably have never heard of this, but there's something called a fly-in. This is a way to influence Congress. So this is where, let's say, I'm going to pick on Apple just for fun. I could name a number of other firms. But I'm the person in charge of getting the patent law changed to help Apple's bottom line. So what do? I go to my CEO and say, you need to fly very quietly to Washington and go talk to these 10 senators about how upset you are with the current patent system, in secret, off the record. So there were repeated fly-ins by all of the CEOs of all of the big companies that wanted big changes. Again, it's perfectly proper. Conversations with members of Congress don't have to be in a public hearing, don't have to be in a public room, so it's not nefarious. But it was a systematic campaign to try to influence Congress before anybody else would even know what was going on. It went on for several years, essentially undetected. Later, the Business Software Alliance morphed into a larger, more potent group called the Coalition for Patent Fairness. So I'm just going to call it the Fairness Coalition for short. So this is basically about 20 companies, but really driven by six or seven Silicon Valley giant companies, such as Apple and the others. They were very upset about damage awards, venue problems, too many suits in Eastern Texas, and various other things. And as I said earlier, some legitimacy is not fiction. But the question is calibration. How big is the problem? How often is the problem? What are the current solutions to deal with the problem? How inadequate are they or are they not? And that sort of got lost in the shuffle because it just became a lobbying slugfest. So then another coalition formed and got very active called the 21st Century Coalition. And to a great extent, it fought to blunt the push of the Fairness Coalition. So these two huge coalitions funded by very large global companies, you know, Apple and the Fairness Coalition and GE and many like diversified giant global companies in the 21st Century Coalition. And these two coalitions battled and battled and spent $300 million, planted editorials, and had people doing interviews and more fly-ins and on and on and on. There was a third coalition, which kind of never got in the door or off the ground, called the Innovation Alliance. It was smaller, and it was pretty much led by Qualcomm and Tessera, which are companies that do engineering and invention, but also do a lot of licensing and monetization of patents. So they had sort of their own somewhat different perspective than the two giant coalitions. But because they weren't a giant coalition, they didn't really get much of a hearing. But many other people didn't get a hearing either. For example, now I should give you the numbers. Eight companies, really the hardcore group of the Fairness Coalition, 50 companies, the total membership of the 21st Century Coalition, but about eight companies, really the hardcore of that coalition too, two companies, the hardcore of the Innovation Alliance that maybe had a dozen members at its max. So let's get perspective. In America today, and then as well, there are 30,000 business corporations, 30,000. So we have two coalitions, whether you count the hardcore or the membership hardly matters. So we have two coalitions running the show, representing fewer than 100 corporations out of 30,000 corporations in America. Now there's a group called the U.S. Business and Industry Council, and there are many other like groups. I just picked this one out to illustrate. It has several thousand members. They're mostly small and middle-sized domestic corporations, often in manufacturing areas. So they tried to sort of get heard, literally get heard by being witnesses at the hearing, get heard by meetings with members, get heard by being at the stakeholder meetings, which became a regular event, and basically got heard very little. Unions and universities also got heard very little. The research universities of this country are an astounding national treasure, national asset, just like the private bar is. The unions, all the employees, or, well, not all the employees, but the employees of those companies that have unionized manufacturing, also could hardly get hurt. And as a matter of fact, the unions were told, union leaders started to get very interested because they saw maintaining a strong, fair but strong patent system as a job-retaining, job-creating engine, and they were very worried about the future of their members because, of course, we're offshoring jobs like crazy all through the last 30 years and at an accelerating rate, so union jobs are becoming harder and harder to find. So the unions were told, if you don't stop opposing the AIA, you will suffer on bills now in Congress dealing with union membership and how the decision gets made whether a certain company or factory will be a union shop or not. The universities also were somewhat intimidated, I'm told. I can't prove this, but I'm told. Because they were told, if you don't back off your opposition to some parts of this bill, the flow, the massive flow of federal government research and development money to your university will be crimped. So you better watch it. So I'm told that the president of numerous major research universities had meetings with totally conflicting views. So the official in charge of licensing the patents owned by the University of California, for example, would come and tell the president, this bill has some bad stuff in it, some good stuff, but some very bad stuff is going to be very bad for our university patents, our licensing, our income from the licensing that the university needs, and so on. So the president says, yeah, it sounds terrible, you know, I'll look into this. So then the head of research at the same university comes to see the president and says, Madam President, Mr. President, we're worried about the flow of federal cash. We're totally dependent on the R&D money from National Institutes of Health, the Defense Department, Energy Department. We can't afford to take the risk that flow of money will be restricted. So you better be careful. So basically what I'm told happened is in every instance, the president of the university overruled the position of the licensing officials in favor of the concerns of the research czar of the university. So there was some intimidation that went on at the hands of Congress, but of course it all circles around because there was a lot of heavy lobbying to get the bill in a certain shape. I mentioned stakeholder meetings. So these went on with increasing frequency, but not everybody was invited, and they were essentially in secret. A cynic would call them contributors meetings because the way you got in the room was to be a really big company that's spending really a lot of money on lobbying, and not just lobbying and PR firms and law firms, but also campaign contributions. So it all became about money, which is, you know, a big problem in our national government right now. So I'll give you one example of how this shakes out. At the very end of the 7 years of hearing, after I got off the court, I got called as a witness by the House Judiciary Subcommittee. And this is in the latter days of the hearings. It might have been almost the last hearing, maybe one more after that. And it was kind of a fluke. I got called by the minority because they couldn't find anybody else or something. So I'm at the table with the head IP lawyer from GE, he's representing the second giant coalition, the 21st Century Coalition, and the head lawyer for the Fairness Coalition, a guy from Intel named David Simon. So we're the three witnesses. So they represent their giant coalitions, and they testify about what they want in the bill, what they don't want in the bill. And I pointed out to the congressman that I was the only person in the room who was neutral, who didn't have any money at stake, who didn't have to protect or advance the bottom line of a tight group of companies. And rather than having added credibility as a result of that, it made me irrelevant. It was perfectly obvious that the members on the committee had no interest in what I had to say because I wasn't backed by any big money. I wasn't going to spawn any campaign contributions. I wasn't going to get them any press. I wasn't going to be helpful. In fact, I might have been a bit of a problem. So it just shows how dominated by big money and big corporations the process had become. So then what's the result? What did all this activity give us? So we got the AIA. If you look at the details, you can draw your own conclusions. But I'm going to suggest that we should step back and look at it from a very different standpoint. The three biggest problems in the American patent system in recent decades are, number one, terrible delays. Talked about those earlier. Number two, high unpredictability of outcomes, which kills business decision-making, investment decision-making. And third, high costs. They're the three overarching problems for decades, and they got worse every year. So what did the AIA do about those three? That's very important. We'll come back to that. Because of the push of the companies most unhappy with the current patent system, the three things that were the top issues in the first bill introduced were damages, venue reform, and interlocutory claim construction appeals. By the end of the process, because of the pushback by the 21st Century Coalition against the Fairness Coalition, the bill covered damages, venue reform, and interlocutory appeals on claim construction, not at all. So the three major pillars of the bill in 05 fell out totally. So what happened about the overarching issues of delays, cost, and unpredictability? Well, almost nothing, other than some protection of the fees and some ability to raise the fees, which is probably the single best thing about the act. My assessment is that the net effect, at least in the short run of the AIA, will be to make all three of those overarching problems even worse. Costs will go up, unpredictability will go down, and the delays will get even worse. Why? Because a lot more issues and a lot more proceedings now have to go on in both the patent office and the district courts than before. Well, is there anything good in the AIA? Yes. It stopped fee diversion, meaning taking patent fee money and putting it in another program or agency or pet project. But what it didn't stop is what I'll call fee sequestration. So if the patent office collects more money in fees in a given year than the spending ceiling set by the Congress, they can't spend the so-called excess fee money, the interesting term that they call it that, without further congressional permission. Now, we all know about the fiscal cliff, and we all know about spending cuts, and we all know the country doesn't have a national budget. So if anybody thinks they can count on the patent office being able to spend all the fee money to finance the upgrades of the IT systems and hiring much more experienced examiners and retaining good examiners, et cetera, I think they're kidding themselves, but only time will tell. But it did help because the fees were raised, and the fee-raising authority was shifted from Congress to the Patent Office under certain criteria. So that was the best thing in the bill. What was the second best thing in the bill? The second best thing in the bill was what was not in the bill. Nothing on damages, nothing on venue, nothing on interlocutory appeals, which would have been very harmful in my opinion. Third best thing was the creation of the patent pilot program to have a volunteer group of federal judges sort of specialized to an extent, not 100%, but to an extent, in trying patent cases because, as you would guess, when people do things a lot, they get better and better and better at it. If they only do it once every 3 years, it takes decades to get to be very good at it. Now, the bill was touted as shifting us to the first-to-file system as opposed to the first-to-invent system. That was supposed to be the great thing that this bill did. I consider that, at best, a secondary improvement. I think it is an improvement, all in all, but pretty minor. So if that's the best thing about the bill, not much of a bill. A mouse, not a mountain. It's true it ends interferences. That's probably a good thing, but it wasn't a major reform. Now, the sleeper in the bill is that it totally changes what prior art is, which is the key thing in what's patentable and what's not patentable. What's already in the prior art? Is this really new? Has to also be useful, but forget about that for a moment. Is it really new, and is it non-obvious? That involves a comparison with a prior art. So when you define what is prior art, you're really skewing the scales one way or the other. So they totally rewrote the prior art law, which got almost no attention, almost no analysis, and we have no idea how it's going to work out in practice. But we do know that the Congress left critical terms totally undefined. So the key determinant of what's prior art and what isn't is the word disclosure. If somebody makes a disclosure, like in an academic article, say by an engineering professor at a university, that can count as a disclosure, maybe. Does it have to be an enabling disclosure? Does it have to pass the written description test? What does it have to do to count as prior art or not? No one knows, not defined, no legislative history worth a darn. Another word, technological. If certain things are technological, it's okay. If they're not technological, it's not okay. No definition, no guidance, no clue, and on and on. There also is a phrase in there, or otherwise publicly available, undefined, unclear, may take the courts upward of a decade to wring out the ambiguity Congress has planted in this bill. And there are other phrases too. Who's the real party in interest? Who's a privy? Who's a stop? What does it mean to say you reasonably could have raised a certain invalidity challenge in the patent office? Because if you could have, you can't raise it later in the court. But if you couldn't have, you can raise it later in the court. So now we're going to have satellite litigation in the district courts about whether I, as the challenger to an issued patent, could reasonably have raised the precise ground I'm now trying to raise in the district court on invalidity previously in patent office. So we're going to spend a decade straightening out the ambiguity. We're spawning a huge amount of satellite litigation, both to define terms and then case by case to deal with the facts. So is the AIA a big improvement, a little improvement, a mixed bag, a revolutionary, wonderful change that's going to give us the 21st century gold-plated patent system? Take your choice. I leave it up to you. My net assessment is it has some good, some bad, some stuff that's just terrible. The business method patent provision, total sellout to 10 megabanks on Wall Street who spend a ton of money, just like the giant IT firms did. Campaign contributions, lobbying. So Senator Schumer jammed into this bill a special provision. It's different for, you know, everybody else has one set of rules, but the New York banks or other financial institutions have another set of rules. So talk about special interest litigation. I mean, now we have two patent systems, you know, one for banks and one for everybody else. So does this make any sense? Do we really want to balkanize the patent system by sector of the economy? So a mixed bag, I would say, at best. But the important thing is to connect the process in your mind, the way it evolved, the way it came into being, with the product. And so then the question going forward when the second half of the football game resumes is, can we have a better process? Can we have some facts, some figures, some cause and effect analysis? Can we get academics and other people who are more neutral to be in the conversation, not only giant companies trying to spend money to protect their bottom line? Yeah, we can. We could if people get mobilized, if the Congress is responsive. Remains to be seen whether it'll happen or not. But this conference is a very useful, important conference because it's focusing on how did we get where we are now and is there a better way going forward? Thanks so much for your very kind attention.